Hi, I'm Jay Washburn.
And I'm Joe Bendusky.
And this is Start Writing.
And today we'll be discussing emotional genres, looking at what emotions readers look for in specific genres as kind of the driving reason for why they pick it up in the first place or why they continue to come back to it. But first, we have This Week in Critiques.
Okay, I'm going to give two examples, and I think they actually relate to our discussion pretty well. The first is a movie called Adrift. It's based on a true story about a shipwreck and being stranded at sea. It happened like 2 decades ago or something. So the beginning of the movie is the shipwreck, right? The very beginning. But and then there are two timelines going on at the same time. So after you use the shipwreck, like this horrifying, it's like terrifying, like very emotional. Use that as your hook. And then that timeline proceeds forward. Like, how do you recover from this shipwreck, right? Mm-hmm. There's this terrible storm they were in. Then there's a second timeline, which is about basically a romance, right? A young guy and a young girl meet. And you slowly see that they're about to get on a boat together, and it's going to lead to that shipwreck, right? So the entire movie is these two timelines going back and forth. And one is this couple that you know is doomed because you just got traumatized by the opening hook. And then the other one is like, how do you recover from that? And those two weaving together means that at the beginning of the movie, you have the hook, which is the shipwreck. And then in the other timeline, you're leading up to the shipwreck at the end of the movie. So it's at the beginning and at the end, and it's traumatizing both times. Anyway, it was just like a genius way, I thought, to use. I mean, this is a fact-based, like this is a real event. And they use that and like kind of, they change the ordering to just ramp up the drama. And man, I felt like it was a genius move. So there's one tip. I've been reading a lot of sci-fi. I read one called We Are Legion, We Are Bob. And yeah, you can tell from the title that it's like slightly silly sci-fi. The premise is, well, you can tell from the title that this guy becomes a sentient machine, right? And so he starts replicating himself. And so the problem is you have a single character, Bob, but there's multiple versions of him, mm-hmm. right? And the genius move that I got out of this was it's not Bob 1 and then Bob 2 and Bob 3. Like, when Bob duplicates himself the first time, he makes his duplicate name himself differently. Mm. And so one Bob is like, I'm going to be Riker from Star Trek, right. Next Generation maybe. One of them's like, well, I'm going to be Homer. And like, these are all characters that Bob loves, but now these multiple versions of himself, like, we as readers can immediately say, oh, that's Homer. I know, like Homer Simpson, right?
Right.
I know him, and I can immediately, like, attach to that new Bob. And so, like, it would have been a huge problem if it was Bob 1, Bob 2, Bob 3. And this fixed that. Like, it was so easy to keep track of the characters because it's like, oh, I know who Riker is. Like, I have an image in my head just like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was another genius move to, like, work with a tricky character situation.
Yeah, like that is really brilliant.
Yeah.
Although I would say 50 years from now, that technique stops working. So if the novel survives the test of time, the tool does not.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Okay, so I have one. So I just read book one in the Red Sparrow trilogy.
Oh.
And so this is big spoilers here. I actually don't know. I haven't seen the movie. But I doubt they end the movie this way. Because this is the end of the book. So, again, big spoilers right here. So, at the very end of the book, what happens is they decide to... even though she's technically working for the Americans, the Russians don't know that. So, they capture her and they trade her back to Russia for one of the American spies that the Russians caught. That's like the end of the movie. It's like, what? That's it? Like, it didn't even feel like a big climax or anything. Like, I remember, like, the chapter ended. I'm like, what the heck? So, it was just, yeah, I was just really stunned that that was the end.
Wait, because it's not dramatic enough?
Yeah, like, it just didn't feel like the end. Like, yeah.
Well, so was there an antagonistic force that you were expecting to be taken out?
So I guess a few chapters before that, they have a fight with with a guy who's interested, who's introduced. It's very much an evil person, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but the fight with him is fairly quick.
Okay.
And I don't know. I guess it didn't feel like a lot was resolved in the chapters following that, which made it feel like that was, couldn't have been the climax because I didn't feel any resolution after. And so I assumed it was still building, and then it ended.
Wait, and so, like, what's the takeaway? What, like, how well, would you have done the ending?
I think, one, the climax just did not feel strong enough to feel like a climax. But also, I think the lack of resolution in those final chapters also communicated to me as a reader, there's still more to go. Now, I had listened to this in an audiobook, and I wasn't tracking the hours, which is part of the reason I was so surprised. And if I'd had a physical book, I would have known
it was coming. It didn't feel like it was ending.
So,
well, I was going to say usually. But yeah, most books, I think, you can tell the antagonistic force is about to be confronted.
Yeah.
It's going to hit the fan.
yeah. Like, I think just thinking of Oathbringer. Which I read recently.
I haven't read it yet.
There is this huge battle. Goes for chapters. All the characters deal with just these overwhelming challenges. They all have these big all-is-lost moments. And then they're able to just barely nudge it out. And then after, we have the resolution of various relationships and whatnot. You know, some romances come together. Some end permanently. And so forth. Like is a strong climax and a definitive resolution, you know. All the romances they've been building and developing within that novel, like I said, they either come together or end in the resolution period of the novel, right? Like, there's still a lot more to go on. Like, this was a huge battle of a major war. But it felt like the climax. Like, I remember even in the resolution, I was like, the book's over. How long is this going to keep going? Like, the resolution was really long. I was actually surprised. But I had no doubt in my mind I was in the resolution.
Yeah.
You know, whereas with Red Sparrow, I never even knew I hit the climax. Okay, so our discussion. Emotional genres. So Writing Excuses talked about this, and the term they had kind of used for this was elemental genres. Now, there was a difference there, because they were talking about a style of writing. Whereas I'm going to be talking about just basic human emotions and some of the neurochemicals that drive those emotions, and then we'll connect that to story elements. So there's kind of an intersection between those two, but it's fuzzy. But yeah, so they did a series on elemental genres if you want to look that up. So looking at these emotional genres, the first thing we want to do is kind of break down human neurobiology. And so we have a lot of neurochemicals that make us up. And in our genetic code...
This is why people love this podcast, because you do stuff like this.
But in our genetic codes, we have either an overproduction of certain chemicals, or we develop a preference for certain chemicals. So you've heard the term adrenaline junkie. These are people who derive a lot of pleasure from adrenaline experiences. Not everybody does. And that's just in your genetics, the way you have that preference for those chemicals. And if you're not an adrenaline junkie, guaranteed that the things you like to do are stimulating specific neurochemicals that you enjoy more. So we'll talk about some of these, like dopamine is a pleasure chemical, but it's also strongly associated with new experiences. Oxytocin is kind of a bonding chemical. It's about connecting with other people. Serotonin has a lot to do with socializing. So if we take, for example, a serial dater, someone who just dates a lot of people and they kind of move very quickly from one relationship to another, what you see is a craving for serotonin, these changing new social environments, with dopamine, that novel new experience, you know, and so they're just moving from one to another, and there's definitely a strong draw to that chemical experience. You know, whereas conversely, someone who commits very quickly to a relationship is probably driven by oxytocin and serotonin. Right? They like that bonding feeling to another person. And so they commit into a relationship very quickly. And because they're very relationship driven, it's that serotonin component, that very strong social drive. So you can kind of break down, like, essentially you can break these down into kind of personality types, right? Instead of, you know, talking about colors or the Myers-Briggs. What we're talking about here is what is your chemical preference? And then people then have different ways of deriving that from various activities. So what we're looking at here is what are the chemical combinations that are then making up the emotions that drives people to read certain kinds of books? And how do we make sure they experience that feeling when they read your book? So that they feel satisfied, right? You picked up the book to have this emotional experience. And if you get it, you walk away satisfied. And if you don't, you won't. You know, it's really that simple. And people may not even be able to identify that, saying, you know, like, if you had asked me before I became a writer why I liked read fantasy, I'd be like, I like dragons and swords, I don't know. But I can now explain it to you very clearly why. So the next concept we want to talk about is anticipation and build, because it's a key concept in writing. So the human brain has kind of this anticipation for an emotional payoff or any kind of payoff can actually generate a stronger response when the payoff comes if there's been enough anticipation building towards that. And so we use cues and situations to kind of understand how that's coming. That's a big part of how foreshadowing plays into a story, right? Sometimes you think, well, I don't want to reveal the ending. I want that to be a surprise. But in putting that in there, you can build anticipation for the ending.
So, and that actually relates to that movie Adrift. The opening sequence of the shipwreck is traumatic. But right. It's even worse leading up to it at the end of the film, because you know how bad it is. Yeah. And it just fills you with this anxiety and dread because you know what's coming.
So talking about how big this anticipation creating bigger reward payoffs is, $38 billion industry is built on this, and that's the lingerie industry. And so they did scientific studies with mice. So they'd get these mice these little red vests. They would have the female mice wear. Because essentially what they're saying is lingerie in itself is not sexually appealing, but rather it is that we are told that it is a cue to anticipate sexual activity that then makes it that. Right? And so what they were doing with these mice is when they were breeding them, half of the female mice were then given these red vests, and they would then monitor the brain activity of the males. And once they had made that association that this female in the red vest is in heat, they would have stronger testosterone spikes and emotional reactions to the female mouse.
That's so weird.
Because that anticipation was put into the situation for them. And like I said, $38 billion industry is built off this exact idea, right? If this was not a component of human psychology, it wouldn't work. Nobody would care. Nobody would buy it. Be like, no, wouldn't naked be better? Be like, no, because of the way the human brain works, lingerie is better than naked because it builds that anticipation so that when it's achieved, you get a bigger emotional payoff than if it was just normal. We'll look at thriller. In writing, we have a genre called thriller, but in film, they don't. In film, they call it suspense. And a big reason for that is that's the actual emotion that people look for in those kinds of stories, is suspense. Now, suspense is all about anticipation. It all is all about being able to anticipate negative consequences and usually having a small hope that it will work out, that they'll find a way around these incoming negative consequences, right? It's like somebody sitting on the train tracks, you see the train coming, and they do nothing, right? Great book and movie, Stand By Me. So Stephen King writes the book Stand By Me. So there's Teddy. He's kind of a crazy wild kid. It's all a bunch of kids. They're 12, 13 years old. And there's a dead body. And they want to get the credit for finding it. So they have to go find it and then call it in. And they've never seen it. So they go on this big, like, just trek through the countryside to find this dead body. And they cross these train tracks. And Teddy, who's a little bit crazy, wants to do a train dodge. So he stands on the track, and the goal is to just stand there as long as possible and not let the fear override you. And his friends are freaking out because There is literally a train headed towards him, and he is refusing to move, right? And so now you have this anticipation, right? Will the fear get to him in time and he'll move? And are his reflexes quick enough that when he decides to move, if not motivated by fear, will he be fast enough, right? There's a very real consequence you can anticipate, but there's also hope. And what happens is one of his friends ends up tackling off the tracks so that, you know, it doesn't happen. Later on, they get stuck on a big bridge way over water, and the train is coming again, and they are just running as fast as they can to get away from the train. And one of them trips and falls, right? And so it's just all about those...
Dang, dude. That was very suspenseful.
Yeah, so it's all about suspense. Because we talk about Star Wars a lot, I'll reference that as a source here. So there's the scene where you see C-3PO and R2-D2. They hide behind a door, and then R2-D2 locks it. And then a few scenes later, you see the stormtroopers in the same alley going through, opening the doors, and they're even trying to pick the lock on that exact door. And so in that moment, again, we have suspense. We know they're there, and we can see the stormtroopers trying to force the door open. If you remove either of those components, the suspense is gone. If we don't know the droids are in there, that scene becomes exposition. That they're searching the city. That's what the stormtroopers are doing. We now know that. If we don't see the stormtroopers shooting, we just see them hiding in there, we now know they're hiding from the troopers, right? There's no suspense in that scene, because we don't have both components. So because of that, thrillers are often written in that third-person narrative so that we can see the antagonist working against the protagonist and we can anticipate those consequences when those two collide, like a train and a person on a track, right? You have that collision of events, and that's what's creating that suspense. So there are thrillers that are written in first person, but it is a little more difficult. You have epistolary versions, so it's letters. So those are written in all first person, but they're from different people. And that's kind of a way to write the thriller in first person with still having those anticipatable consequences. Mm. In The Martian, Mark Watney is able to either verbally talk about or just in his thoughts think about the problems and the potential problems on Mars. And so when we see those things starting to occur, he's already given us the details on how it will cause problems for him. And so you can kind of anticipate it that way.
Man, they about three quarters of the way through the book, or maybe halfway, it jumps out of the first person and goes to NASA.
Yeah, yeah.
There's some... I remember thinking when I read it, I was like, oh, that was weird.
Yeah.
Shifted viewpoints.
Yeah. So action-adventure. This is all about new places and immediate action and consequence, right? We're not anticipating this anymore. It's just happening. So Indiana Jones was kind of based on these early versions of stories, and they're very much adrenaline-driven, right? Whereas with Indiana Jones, like, if you think about, like, the Temple of Doom with the carts racing there on the track, there's not, you know, you don't have long anticipation between... You know, events. Everything's happening right now, and there's immediate consequences for these decisions. You know,
man, I love those movies.
And even when you get, you know, a little bit of anticipation, it's usually not more than 30 seconds out, right? There's not a lot there.
Yeah.
These, like, part of this is based around the whole travel junkie, right? A lot of people know travel junkies who just love to go see new places and visit them, and that's kind of a dopamine-driven experience, right? They like the new, something they haven't seen or done before, but it's combined with adrenaline craving. So it's a very specific personality type that way. And so usually, again, going back to Indiana Jones, this takes place in an exotic place that either most people haven't been or even that they can't go to, right? So Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, particularly when it was made, a lot of these countries were even off limits for visiting, mm-hmm. right? Similarly, Temple of Doom, these are, you know, very backwoods parts of India that as a general tourist doesn't even get to see, right? So it's not just another country, it's parts of it that tourists don't usually see, right? It's a whole new experience that way. And then, of course, driven with a lot of action to pump up the adrenaline. So this is a little bit different from fantasy, because we'll talk about later. Fantasy is about a sense of wonder, because with fantasy, you see a new world, but it's not your world. And so that's kind of a difference between the two, is that traditional action-adventure genre, usually it's their world they're more interested in. So mystery is about the feeling of insight, right? This flash of brilliance you have when you solve the puzzle. And it's about solving the puzzle either before you get all the pieces or at least before the protagonist does. Before you're given the answer, you want to put this together, right? And it makes you feel very smart, right? And that's a feeling that the readers want when they read mystery. And for that reason, mysteries are usually told in first person, or if they're third, they only follow the protagonist. Because if we suddenly start writing a chapter from the antagonist position, then the mystery's solved. You've switched from mystery to thriller because I am not putting the pieces together anymore, right? And so, oddly enough, thriller mysteries get thrown into the same genre, but the emotional draw of those two kinds of stories is very different for the readers, right? One wants suspense, the other wants insight, you know?
So what about a Da Vinci Code that I feel like has an element of mystery? You're trying to figure out who the bad guy is, but it's also very much a thriller.
It is, yeah. That is actually a really good blend of the two genres. He's targeted both audiences with that style of the story because there is a mystery that you can try and put together before him for that flash of insight, but there's also a lot of suspense elements that drive it. And I think what was done there is the mystery is a mystery to both sides, right? Whereas a lot of times you're trying to figure out who the murderer is, and so you can't tell that mystery from both sides because otherwise you reveal who the murderer is. Whereas with the Da Vinci Code, the mystery is the Da Vinci Code, and the thriller is about the two people competing to get the answer to it.
Yeah.
Same thing with National Treasure, right? It's a thriller mystery, but the mystery is not known to anyone. They're trying to crack these national secrets, but there are two sides competing, which creates a thriller component.
Oh, that's cool.
So romance, love, and lust, and it kind of depends on where you fall on the spectrum, which emotion they're really pursuing here. So this is kind of a self-evident genre, right? I mean, it's not a confusion about what emotion people want for it. They want to have the feeling of falling in love or being in love and fighting to keep it. And so as the steaminess of the novel increases, you have kind of a switch from love to lust. Like erotica, these people want the sensation of lust. That's why they're reading erotica, right? Whereas, you know, more of a sweet romance, they're just looking for that sensation of falling in love, you know? And some people go in looking for both and they'll read kind of the middle of the road. They want both sides. So how this is achieved, and this genre is driven by us understanding and connecting to the protagonist more than anything, right? Because you have to stimulate empathy, right? Our ability to feel the emotions of another person. And once the bigger the connection we feel to another person, the stronger our empathy is for their emotional experiences. So by connecting the reader very effectively to that protagonist, when the protagonist falls in love, the reader falls in love. And so that is really the key to making that genre work, is about making sure that they can connect very deeply to that protagonist. Now, back in our POV episode, we talk about, you know, one of the really easy ways to do this is to write in first person. But here's the weird thing about romance. A lot of romance readers don't like first person. They prefer a third person narrative. However, YA romance is almost exclusively first person, just because YA is first person.
Why do readers prefer third?
They do? For romance?
No, I'm asking.
For the moment, almost all YA romances are still written in first person, just because YA is.
But adult romance, you said people prefer third person over first. And why is that?
I don't know. I talked to several romancers, or I guess I messaged them on Facebook, and they said, no, my readers don't like first person. So
yeah, I don't. It seems like you can get deeper into the head of the person.
Yeah. But I mean, if your writing style is strong enough, you can get just as deep in third person.
So yeah.
As to why that is, I don't know. Maybe it's maybe it's if these people are in a relationship and they're reading in that first person, maybe it makes them feel slightly unfaithful, which is why they don't like it. I don't know. Like it's, and I don't have a sample size to tell you if this is a large enough sample for statistical data. I contacted 4 romance writers. They gave me the preference on their readers. But like I said, so even here, that information may be a little off. Hmm. So that was just based on the feedback I was getting from the people I was talking to. So fantasy. This is a sense of wonder. And it's about seeing something you've never seen before, but it's also something incredible, something unbelievable, right? Beyond possibility. And that is kind of what drives that sense of wonder. And the reason a lot of people go to fantasy for that is it's incredibly hard to achieve in normal life. Like a lot of people experience, like when they see the Grand Canyon for the first time, they experience a sense of wonder because it's just, as much as it's called the Grand Canyon, as much as you've seen pictures of it, you don't really feel it until you're there and you realize, yeah, like I remember I had this experience when I saw this, the St. Peter's Basilica for the first time, right? It's one thing to see pictures or even video of it, but to see it in real life, like, you're just overwhelmed. Like, it borders on the impossible what was done there. It's just incredible.
That's like, awesome.
And that's what draws readers to fantasy, is to see the impossible brought to life. And so, yeah, they want to see something new. And that's where there's a lot of world creation. Yeah. Is that's part of, you know, there's magic and there's world creation because that's how you bring that experience to the reader. And I think one of the real challenge in writing fantasy series is how do you bring something new each time to the reader, right? Which creates a real difficulty in writing series or long fantasies. Because if they're coming for wonder, how do you deliver that in the next book and the next book?
So I just want to throw in here that I think another emotion that I look for in fantasy is courage or like valor.
But you could look for that anywhere.
Well, true. But so it takes courage to run into a burning building or to like dodge. You're in a car chase, right? Like, so I'm thinking thriller genre, or it takes courage to speak to a woman that you have not yet been introduced to, right? Mm. But in fantasy, you can take that principle of courage and you can say, well, what if there were this creature that was like massive and it had these massive wings and sharp teeth? Like, so you can illustrate courage, which you can in the real world too, but in a different way, almost like metaphorically. I feel like fantasy can take us deep into these metaphors and sometimes illustrate things that I think can be harder to access in other ways. Hmm. But yeah, so I guess what I'm saying is like facing a dragon in a fantasy novel helps me understand courage, which is usually like a smaller emotion in real world situations. Hmm. I don't know. That's how I think about
it. That's because you're a fantasy writer. I think about it that way. All right, so sci-fi is similar to fantasy, but it's more about pondering possibilities. Right, even if they're far distance possibilities from where we are now, it's still like connected to the science of our world. And so it's like, oh, I wonder if one day we could do that. Right. So there's still this, it borders on wonder, but it's also driven by this possibility.
It's like curiosity.
Yeah. Kind of like curiosity. Be like, I wonder if we could do that. Right. Nobody wonders, I wonder if we could do magic. No, there's no magic. It's just like, But with sci-fi, you have that, could we, a kind of attachment to it. And so that's kind of what drives it. Now, there's a subgenre within sci-fi called hard science. And so these people like just as much of the really hard science. So if you look at The Martian, very much a hard science sci-fi story. Because as much as there are a few gaps in our current technology that he has to fill in, most of it was still very much things we can do now. And then you see what's done with it to survive on Mars. And so you see that possibility.
Man, and I was about to say that we've been talking about emotion, but then sci-fi was logic, right? Because it's like, oh, could we do this? But then I realized it's still about the emotion that you feel when you think logically through this possibility. So it is about logic, but it's about feeling the logic, I think.
Yeah.
Like getting excited. You're like, whoa, what if we really did that? That'd be sweet.
So this episode kind of has a right to market feel. You can really write however you want, wherever you want. But when you stray, the genres exist as a marketing component. And so we're talking about them as, you know, what drives people to read them. And so if you choose to write sci-fi without those components, the people who read sci-fi aren't going to enjoy your book as much. You need to be targeting a different audience. So the example I'll bring up is Shadow Self by Brandon Sanderson. So when they were doing the talking about their elemental genres, Sanderson even mentioned that he had written this book in the stylings of horror. Like that was the elemental genre. It was in his fantasy world, in his fantasy series, and it had magic and everything. But it was written as though it was a horror novel. And I really didn't enjoy it at all. As the series, I didn't care for it.
Wait, have you read a horror novel that you did enjoy?
No. I get very angry reading horror.
Okay, so just as a general, you don't like that genre, and you got tricked into reading it.
Yeah, yeah. Essentially. So, because I don't read the genre because I don't enjoy it, you know. And so that's what had happened there. He had gone off genre in the way he chose to tell a story because I read that genre for a specific reason. And I didn't experience that in that book. So I didn't enjoy it. You know. So like I said, the genres exist because people are reading in that genre for a specific emotion. And if you're not delivering it, they're going to walk away unsatisfied. And so my advice is you might want to switch genres just a little bit. You know, be like, but I love dragons. and I don't want to write about wonder, you know. Well, it creates a complicated issue because people who are reading that want to feel wonder.
That's crazy. Okay, so you said in romance you need to have like strong character emotion, right?
Strong connecting to the character. Okay, right? The reader needs to connect very strongly to the character.
So what happens when you do that in a fantasy novel? So you take the strength of romance and ratchet it up a bit in your fantasy.
So there's the genre called the romance fantasy. Like it's a whole genre.
Okay.
So there's dragons and swords.
So you can mix and match all of these we've discussed.
Yeah, a lot of them can be mixed and matched, and there's subgenres, right? There's so you have sci-fi, but you also have what's called future fantasy, which is technically what Star Wars is, because you have the Force, which is essentially magic. The Force is magic.
And zero science in the whole movie.
And so as much as Star Wars looks like a sci-fi and movie genres will classify it as sci-fi, as a reading genre, it's future fantasy. Because it actually doesn't have a lot of the components sci-fi readers want, right? We're not talking about science, and we're not talking about developing technologies and different things like that. And but future fantasy. So you have swords and magic, but there's also technology.
Man, so I was going to ask a question about turning up the knobs on all of these emotions. But then I realized that what that would do, it makes the others less powerful because it's a trade-off every time.
Yeah.
So if you're spending more time on the romance aspect, you're spending less on the wonder of the fantasy.
Right.
And so I guess there's a balance. You got to decide, okay, do I want tons of wonder or do I want half and half?
Well, and so, you know, I mean, if you're writing a massive book like a Sanderson that's 300,000 pages.
You can't do it all.
there's room to do it all, but you also have to remember the readers who pick that book up are not looking for it all. They're there for a specific reason.
Yeah.
You know? So turning up all the knobs doesn't necessarily make a better story because then your reader's getting less of the reason they're actually there.
Yeah.
Right?
That makes sense. Oh, dude, this is good.
All right. That's the end of our episode, so it's time to start writing. Thanks for listening. You can find all of the podcast on Podbean, which is our host, or if you go to joseph-mandoski.com/start-writing. That is the official site, and all the episodes are there. as well as the articles. So we try and convert these to articles with bolds and highlights. So if you're looking for information, particularly on the marketing episodes where you kind of want to go things slower, you can look those up there, as well as our interviews. You can find everything there. If you want to contact us, you can email us at jbendoski@gmail.com. Also, if you just go to the website, you can email from there.
And guys, we love hearing your thoughts and feedback, so drop us a line.
Yeah, so if so, we've been contacted by people who've wanted to do interviews, so we are open to that. Like I said, we're no longer actively pursuing interviews for the moment. But yeah, so thanks for listening, and I guess it'll be next month. We have an interview, so I did an interview at the very end of June that we'll release after this episode. Hey everybody, this is Joe Bendoski. Before I start the episode, I will point out that we actually recorded this episode back, I think maybe even in July, and I was updating the website, and I was looking to link to this episode, only to discover it had never been released. So we do talk about a few things like interviews and different things that we've stopped doing for the time being while Jay and I are busy with our book launches and whatnot. So it's an older episode that was just never released. Antagonists and Villains Part 2 has been moved to next month. I wanted to give Jay a break. He's pushing hard to hit his own book deadlines, and so this would just give him a little more time to get some work done. And so here's this episode. As always, I will bring up that I was emailed this week by an author, and she's working on her first book, and she had been plotting, just plotting like crazy to get this manuscript ready. And she asked me a question as she detailed all the elements of the plot that she had outlined so far, if it was enough. And so I think we've talked about different pieces of this in various episodes in the past, but I thought I'd bring it up here as well. And that is that, there's a difference between plotting and pantsing, or as they call it, gardeners and architects. And the architect does a lot of plotting and planning out beforehand. And the gardener or the pantser, they just sit down and write. And if you're familiar with the work of Brandon Sanderson, you know, he'll have 200 pages of outline for a book of his. I mean, he outlines like crazy in preparation for writing the novel. Whereas George R. R. Martin, who writes the Game of Thrones series, he just sits down and writes. He doesn't have an outline. He's probably got an idea in his head of where he's going, but he just sits down and writes. And my answer to her is as much as I do here, is that you want to find the method that makes writing easiest. It's not about which one is the most time efficient. You know, a lot of people say it probably balances out. The outliner spends more time outlining and less time in revision, and the pantser spends no time in outlining and a lot of time in revision. And I don't know if those timelines balance out, but it's all about just finding the method that makes writing easiest for you. In my own experience, my first novel, I pantsed, and so I would just sit down and write. And every time I sat down and looked at just a blank page to start a new chapter, I dreaded it. I hated sitting down to write those new chapters. I didn't mind revising old ones, but sitting down to write just from blank, it was brutal. And it took me a really long time to get that novel finished. So when I went in to write my second novel, I had kind of an outline set up for myself. I actually tried to outline like crazy, and so I mapped out everything, all the events, all the character arcs, just everything galore. And then when I started actually writing the novel, by the end of the first chapter, I had had some really good ideas that I wanted to follow that would then take me away from the outline that I'd spent forever planning. And it was in that moment that I recognized that a very detailed outline didn't work for me, because I needed freedom to kind of chase new ideas within the chapter. So I sat down again and I made just kind of a brief light outline. I knew the climax I was working towards. I knew the midpoint twist that I wanted. And I knew the inciting incident. And then when I'd sit down at each chapter, I wouldn't just start into the chapter. I'd kind of map that out as well. What was the, you know, kind of the peak emotional that I was working towards, and how would it kind of resolve if I chose to resolve it in that chapter? And so I'd map out a few points like that. And that made writing very easy for me. There was a lot of flexibility and freedom within each chapter to kind of chase new ideas. And it wasn't throwing out massive outlining before. Like I said, I'd only written down 3 or 4 points that I was working towards. And so that is what I found had really worked for me in my writing. And so, as I said before, the method is what works best for you. So I know I put this at the end after everything there, but I just, so that's why you didn't get Antagonists and Villains Part 2. This month is we just had this episode that was unreleased, and to give Jay a little bit more time to really focus on his novel. And I wanted to share that information I had, you know, her response and to outlining and trying to figure out what's best, and you know, find what makes the writing process easiest, so it's not something you dread. You know, if that's having an outline, then outline. And you know, it's a spectrum. For me, I can't go in blank, but I can't have anything too detailed either. So thanks for listening.